I am Pierre Lumumba here at the Aberdare's Country Club in Nyeri County in the Republic of Kenya in the mother continent of Africa. Today we continue our African conversations and we talk about the relationship between the continent of Africa and the United Nations organization. Our history is not very long. It started in 1945 after the Second World War. And it was because the powers that had won the war, the Allied powers, thought that no other war should be fought. And out of the experience of the League of Nations, the United Nations Charter was given life in San Francisco in the United States of America. And it's important to point out that at that time, almost all African countries were under colonization, saving Ethiopia and Liberia. And therefore, they did not participate in coming to the participation that led to the UN Charter. But the UN Charter at that time had become conscious of the fact that a large segment of the world, at that time estimated with a population of nearly 700 million, was under colonial tutelage. It is instructive that the UN Charter does not talk about and does not use the word decolonization. They use the word those who are not self-governing territories. And it's only in the 1960s that the UN begins in earnest and establishes a committee that deals with decolonization without using the word. And this is understandable because between 1940s and 1950s, we see the agitation for the independence of countries which are under colonization. Indeed, one can say that the impetus is given in 1945, particularly when we have the Manchester Conference of Pan-Africanists. And after that, of course, Ghana regains our independence in the year 1957, and thereafter there is a wave of independence. 1958, we begin to see, a little earlier, in fact, with Sudan, 1956, with Guinea in 1958, and then others, Congo in 1960, Tanzania in 1961, and a wave of other independence in the 1960s. And suddenly, by 1963, you have 32 African countries which are independent and are recognized by the international community and become members of the United Nations. So that during that period, one can say that there is a very rosy relationship between the UN and the continent of Africa and the individual countries. And when we talk about the relationship between the UN and Africa, remember that the OAU comes into being on the 25th day of May, 1963. And when it comes into being, the OAU then becomes the continental body that has a direct relationship with the UN. The UN is very sensitive at that time because the architecture of the UN is designed in such a manner that even when and if you talk about the sovereignty of nations, the permanent members are still the international hegemons. They are the hegemons because whatever other countries do, they can exercise their veto power and defeat all that has been done. But to the credit of the UN at that time, there is the inclination and the impetus to do good. There's the impetus to ensure that the countries that are not independent are indeed led out of independence, and the appetite to intervene for purposes of restoring order. And the very first test of this intervention comes in the year 1960s towards the end, and 1961, when Belgium suddenly hands over independence to the Democratic Republic of Congo, then known as Congo, with Joseph Kasavubu as the president and Patrice Emery Lumumba as the prime minister. No sooner has Lumumba settled as the prime minister of Congo than the Belgians plot to remove him, working, of course, in cahoots with the United States of America. And Ludo de Wet writes a beautiful book in this regard, The Assassination of Patrice Emery Lumumba, or L'Assassinat de Lumumba in French. And he demonstrates quite clearly how this was done. And that is the beginning of the rupture of the relationship between the UN and Africa. Because Dag Hammarskjöld, who sometimes is said to be the best UN Secretary General the world has ever had, is seen to be a little reluctant in helping Congo and Lumumba, with the consequence that Lumumba has to turn to Russia or the Soviet Union at that time to help, and to turn to Kwame Nkrumah to help with Ghana, which is a very nascent army. And people begin to question, is this UN that we are talking about, the UN that we want? Of course, their sins are forgiven them, because one of the things that also happens at that time is that they introduce the scheme of what is called the trusteeships. And the trusteeships is to migrate countries which were under colonial powers into a scheme where they are under the UN. The most prominent in this regard is the trusteeship of Southwest African Republic by South Africa. And this is something that has always puzzled me, as it does historians. Why did the UN make Southwest African Republic a trustee of South Africa, which in 1948 had adopted an apartheid regime? But it did. And to their credit, when the West African People's Organization under Sam Nujoma, and indeed one of the participants was the current president Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwah, who is now the president of Namibia, as the young combatants, they begin to agitate for independence, the UN is involved in midwifing the process of ensuring that Namibia regains our independence. And I think that was the high point. It was the high point in the role of the UN in the continent of Africa. Once again, because this relationship is hot and cold, they are seen not to behave as well as they should have done. In Angola, when the Angola people are fighting the administration at that time of Marcelo Caetano in Portugal, they do very little. And indeed, the Angolans regain independence with very little assistance from the United Nations. But that is in the early 60s. Of course, something else will happen a little later. So we see a United Nations which has a dalliance with the continent of Africa in a very useful way sometimes, and not so very useful at times. And this in itself is something that then undermines the confidence of Africans in the United Nations. It is instructive at that time that even when one looks at the complexion of the senior staffing of the UN, African nations are not given their pride of place. You don't have Africans at the higher echelons of the United Nations. You don't have Africans participating in the activities of the UN in a manner that is seen to be helpful to the continent of the continent of Africa. But one begins to see the emergence of certain initiatives, and those initiatives are through the specialized agencies such as UNDP, such as UNESCO, such as UNIDO. And all these are coming with a view to lifting Africa out of poverty, which was a problem in the area of education, in the area of agriculture, in the area of technology, in the area of industrialization. And indeed, even as a young person, some of the secretaries generals of the United Nations were very prominent and were taught in African schools. We were taught about Dag Hammarskjöld. We were taught about General U Thant of Burma. we were taught about Kurt Waldheim. These were some of the early secretary generals of the United Nations, and they were seen to be doing something that was in the interest of the continent of Africa. But Africans are complaining. They are complaining because the process of the decolonization of Africa is not complete, and people are dissatisfied. That is why the OAU then actually chooses to form its own committee for decolonization, which is headquartered in Dar es Salaam. Because they are saying the UN is here. In 1960, it talked about self-governing territories, but it is doing nothing. They are watching. They are saying that we are going to have a UN that is going to be responsive, but they are doing very little. But what happens then? In 1973, something happens that I think is important to note. The UN comes up with the Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. It is something that then puts the mark of Cain on the head of the apartheid regime. It comes into force in 1976, and then they drive the sanctions against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And this is very useful because the UN has then ensured that the crime of apartheid is a punishable crime, and the African South Africa is ostracized in international community and is sanctioned at all critical levels. Of course, they are sanction busters, but South Africa is sanctioned in that regard. And we begin to see from 1976 that the apartheid regime is doing everything to survive. But the beauty is that the international community has now understood that this is a crime against humanity. That pressure is also brought to bear on Rhodesia, which under Ian Smith had declared unilateral independence, and that move is useful. So that when we talk about the United Nations and its involvement in Africa in the 1980s, 1950s through to the 1980s, we see a body that recognizes from a sense of guilt that the African continent ought to be given specialized attentions. Many conventions are made, many decisions are made, but what is not done is to bridge the gulf between the conventions and reality on the ground, so that those who are in the business of giving the statistics would say that on a scale of 1 to 10, what was happening is that the UN was only delivering 5 at the very best. But that is the relationship, and I can understand it. You still have those who are the hegemons, those who are the colonizers, as the moving part of the UN. And that is why, even as we talk about that relationship, the relationship between Africa and the UN remains one of suspicion, and one which is not as rosy and as warm as it should be, because Africans think that the UN could and should have done better for the benefit of the peoples of the continent of Africa, but that they did not and appear not to be as enthusiastic as they ought to be, given the number of African countries which contribute to its well-being. That is the UN and Africa from 1950 to the 1980s. But we'll have a conversation about that from the 80s. What begins to happen? Is it any better? Let us take a break until we come again to continue the conversation.